More practice on detecting logical fallacies from today's news, next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to this week beginning edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today, as usual, is my co-host, our Vice Chairman, a fellow analyst, and all-around good friend and fallacy detective, Chuck Michaelis.
Yes, and it's good, Barry. This kind of thing to me is actually enjoyable. I enjoy picking out fallacies, and some people hate me for it. It's kind of fun, and I'm really sorry to my friends out there if you get mad at me for pointing out things that rub you the wrong way. I got to call them as I see them.
Well, that's fine. And I think that's the reason why you and I are such good friends, because I really enjoy doing this as well. As a matter of fact, anytime I get the opportunity to take something such as from the talking head media or from elected officials, where it's just chock full of really bad ways of going about making your argument, because especially with news media, they're supposed to be reporting facts, not giving their opinion or trying to shape yours. But that's what happens all the time. But it also happens in our daily conversations, and especially when we hear the speeches and videos and things of our politicians. I believe, honestly, Chuck, that it must be some mass hypnosis around the D.C. Beltway that they actually believe most of the things that they say. But when we look at them and analyze them, we can see that they're full of logical fallacy.
Oh, and absolutely. And this is where worldview comes into play, because the fact is that most of these people are operating from a different worldview than a Christian worldview. And therefore, the filters that they're filtering things through, both coming in and going out, are different than what Christians should be utilizing. And that includes a lot of Christian politicians, including some who claim to be Christian, who are running for president.
That's right. So I have a quote for us. You know how much I like to read. I was reading the other day a new book that I got, and it had a quote from another thinker that I actually have this book already in my library. It's called Ideas Have Consequences, and it's by a philosopher by the name of Richard Weaver. And he said, and I quote, since we're talking about this, worldview is the most important thing that we can know about a man. Ideas have consequences. And those consequences affect everything in the practical realm as well as in the theoretical realm. Discernment of worldview is therefore the most necessary of all the tasks of wisdom. That's from Richard Weaver, who was in the 50s and 60s, was a fairly prominent social philosopher, but he got it right down to the right point.
Oh, absolutely.
View of a person, get a judge about, and it's the most important thing we can know is where their basic beliefs lie is going to direct how they do everything, every thought, every action that they have, which is the reason why we've always said on this program and in conversations with people, I don't care about the candidate's record. I care about what he actually believes. Got to get down to the basics of his worldview.
Yes, exactly. And that's exactly what we're going to do today. I think we ought to jump into it in the interest of time,
sure.
Because when we do these things, they chew up time really fast. I want to go back to the show that we did last week. We did an analysis on a Glenn Beck piece, and I mentioned a fallacy that I didn't really define, and that was the straw man fallacy. And you'll see a lot of this, especially at election time. The straw man fallacy is to take someone's position and exaggerate it, blow it out of proportion, take it to a conclusion that is not actually included in that viewpoint, and assign it value to that particular opinion, and then spread that as the way that person actually thinks. When I said that he was doing a straw man on Ron Paul's position, that's exactly what I meant. He was taking and adding to, mischaracterizing, and exaggerating Ron Paul's viewpoint. And we'll go back. We'll actually review that audio. I've actually been able to obtain a clip of that audio. So we'll go back and review it, and we'll point that out. What we're going to listen to today is, if you were with us over the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about the National Defense Authorization Act and now the Enemy Expatriation Act, and we're going to play the audio from Representative Charlie Dent that we actually played, but now we're going to break it down into pieces and talk about it. So I'm just going to start that, and I will stop it in a place, and then Barry and I will discuss the fallacies involved.
Hello, I'm Congressman Charlie Dent. I'm proud to be the sponsor of the bipartisan Enemy Expatriation Act, which I introduced in the House this week, along with Representative Jason Altmaier of Western Pennsylvania. Identical legislation was also introduced in the Senate by Senator Joe Lieberman, chairman of the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, and Senator Scott Brown of Massachusetts. With the recent death of U.S.-born radical cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, the sanctity of American citizenship and its crucial role in our dialogue regarding national security is now garnering increased and bipartisan attention in both chambers of Congress.
Okay, Barry, what did you hear in there that came immediately to the forefront when you heard it?
Well, a couple of things, Chuck. Number one, he used the word bipartisan very broadly. It's a bill that's got deep from both parties, from Republicans and Democrats. Well, I'll give him one part of that, because we've done the research on this bill, that right. Yes, there are Republicans and Democrats on board, because there's only four co-sponsors on the bill, one of them being a Democrat, one of his colleagues from Pennsylvania, and two other Republicans. So if you want to call that truly bipartisan, that's fine. However, I think it's quite misleading. I think it's a park to hole fallacy that having one Democrat on board makes it bipartisan when you're dealing with 435 members of Congress.
Yeah. Okay, think about this. It's gaining bipartisan support. How much support? There are 435 members of the House of Representatives, and there are now a grand total of one sponsor and what, four co-sponsors?
No, he's the sponsor. And there are three co-sponsors in total.
Three co-sponsors. So we've got
two Republicans and one Democrat.
We have about 0.9% of the House of Representatives supporting this bill.
Exactly.
But the fact is, this is not growing bipartisan support. In the Senate, it's actually a little better because 2% of the Senate has jumped onto this bill. It's not really bipartisan in so much there as it is one Republican and one independent. So if they actually pick up a Democratic sponsor, they'll have tripartisan support. In effect, well, Joe Lieberman is a Democrat.
Joe Lieberman is a Democrat who left the Democratic Party, and they won't caucus with him. And he caucused with the Republicans for a while, but then he went wrong on an issue on them. And so now he's truly stuck a man with no party.
Yeah. There's another word in there, though. Let's put it this way. Thing about bipartisan, okay, that is what's called an equivocation fallacy. What the congressman did here was equivocate on how much support that he has and where it comes from. And equivocation is loosening the definition of a word in order to make it fit your situation. The right. fact is that he does not have growing support. He could make the claim that he does have bipartisan support, but it's very weak. I was more worried, however, about another little bit of equivocation that's also something of an appeal fallacy, and that is he used the word to describe American citizenship. He said the sanctity of American citizenship.
Yeah, okay. It makes it sound like it's a sacred and holy thing, but yet he's got a bill that attaches to a piece of law. There are seven ways in the current law your citizenship can be revoked by government. So I'm just wondering just exactly how sacred or how sanctified citizenship really is to our elected officials.
To show what an equivocation that is, what does sanctity really mean?
It means that it can't be taken away from you.
Well, actually, sanctity means, according to Webster's 1828 and modern dictionaries, something that is holy held sacred as in a religious act or state. And the fact is, what he has just done is attempted to apply sainthood to American citizenship. American citizenship is a very important thing, and it should be held dear, and it should be held in high regard. But it is not the same as your church membership, which is a sanctified thing. Your American citizenship is not sanctified. And for those of you who disagree with me, I will gladly hear your arguments, so send them to me. But the fact is, there's nothing sanctified about American citizenship. It's not holy. This is one of those places where we have to talk about the jurisdictional separation of church and state. And the fact is, your church membership is sanctified, your American citizenship is not. Applying that kind of language is an appeal to religion, if you will. Being a United States citizen is not the same as being a Christian by any stretch of the imagination. Let's go back to the thing and listen to some more.
I'm hopeful this renewed attention will increase the awareness of and support for the Enemy Expatriation Act. The bipartisan legislation I introduced this week calls for a pragmatic recognition that a person who is purposefully and materially supporting acts of terror against the United States is demonstrating that they have no intent in acting as a U.S. citizen.
Okay, what did we hear in there?
Well, I heard the word pragmatic, which always gets my radar up. Because anybody starts talking about pragmatism, what they're saying is, we're going to get rid of principle and the rule of law because the situation demands it. So in other words, it's the ends justify the means argument.
Okay, so it's an appeal to pragmatism.
Appeal to pragmatism, that's right. It's totally pragmatic to do this.
That is a logical fallacy.
It is.
Because all you people out there who aren't really pragmatic, we don't want you in on this discussion, or you should come along with our way of thinking. And we also heard the word, once again, for the third time in about a minute and 10 or 15 seconds, bipartisan, which we've already explained. This seems to be an important thing, and I think bipartisan carries with it a certain set of expectations to the hearer. That is what Congressman Dent is heavily trying to leverage. He wants to make sure that basically he gets bipartisan support. So he says he has it so that Democrats who hear this and are thinking pragmatically will contact their congressmen or their senators and say they want them to sign on to this bill. So we've got an appeal to pragmatism. Again, we've got a repeated use of the equivocation fallacy. And also we've coupled it with this appeal to religion. Let's go on and see what else we have here.
They want to engage in hostilities against the American people, and they clearly no longer wish to be a citizen of our great nation.
Okay, what's wrong with that? Does someone who engages in an act necessarily no longer want to be a citizen?
No, that isn't true. I think that's a... I'm not sure. I can't remember what the name of that fallacy is, though, Chuck.
That is more or less a popular appeal.
Okay.
First of all, there's some equivocation in there. Someone who would very often would hook up with a foreign power is someone who wants to see the country radically altered, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are no longer wanting to be an American citizen. It's difficult to explain, but the fact is they want to radically alter maybe what it means to be an American citizen.
Mm-hmm. So you know what, Chuck? I mean, I want to go back just a little bit more. Because that last clip that we played just before this one, you know, he said something else in relation to this whole idea of somebody giving up their citizenship when he talked about the whole idea that this new language in the law is something that it's just common sense. I forget exactly how he put it, but I don't know if you can spot us back to that previous clip.
I'm hopeful this renewed attention will increase the awareness of and support for the Enemy Expatriation Act. The bipartisan legislation I introduced this week calls for a pragmatic recognition that a person who is purposefully and materially supporting acts of terror against the United States is demonstrating that they have no intent in acting as a U.S. citizen. If they want to engage in hostilities against the American people, then they clearly no longer wish to be a citizen of our great nation. Notably, this legislation would only modify an existing statute or law which has already been found constitutional.
Now, you heard what you were looking for in there, I assume.
Yeah, I did. Because he was going back, it's a very similar theme because he said it in two different ways. And that whole idea that if someone engages in hostilities, but if he's only telling half the story, so he's only giving half truths here because, as we talked about last week, this would say that if you were giving any kind of, what we would call in the Constitution, aid and comfort when you're talking about treason, that we give them any material or substantial support. That's not necessarily actively engaging in the hostility itself, but even supporting is enough to trigger the loss of your citizenship. And so he really is talking somewhat around the issue by not telling exactly what the bill does.
Okay, yes. So basically what he's doing is he's throwing up a smokescreen. That really doesn't have a direct fallacy attached. But what he's doing is essentially he's equivocating on what the bill does. So it is an equivocation fallacy. One thing we're learning here, and you know what? We're going to run out of time, just like I feared. One thing we're learning here is that these fallacies don't exist in discrete units. Very often they're mixed up together. And there's a little bit of one, a little bit of another, and a little bit of something else all mixed up, sometimes in the same sentence, sometimes in the same phrase. And that's what we're discovering here.
Well, and we got a big one there at the end of that last clip when he was basically saying that this language is going to be attached onto a statute or a law that's already been found constitutional by the courts. That's a hold apart fallacy. That the whole of the existing law is constitutional, so therefore that makes what we're going to add to it constitutional.
That's right. Now, unfortunately, we are out of time. Let's continue tomorrow.
That sounds like a good plan.
Join us tomorrow for another Principles and Policies, where we'll discuss some more logical fallacies.